knot of men gathered before the Susan Marie that he was not a part of this fraternity of fishermen, that furthermore he made his living with words and was thus suspect to them. On the other hand, he had the advantage of the prominently wounded and of any veteran whose war years are forever a mystery to the uninitiated. These latter were things that solitary gill-netters could appreciate, and offset their distrust of a word-shaper who sat behind a typewriter all day. They nodded at him, and with slight alterations in posture, included him in their circle.
"Figured you'd have heard by now," said the sheriff. "Probably no more than I do."
"Hard to believe," answered Ishmael.
William Joe Vogg tucked his cigar between his teeth.
"It happens," he grunted. "You go fishing, it happens."
"Well, yeah," said Marty Johansson. "But Jesus Christ."
He shook his head and rocked on his heels.
The sheriff brought his left leg down from the piling, hitched his trousers at the thigh, and brought his right up, then settled his elbow on his knee.
"You see Susan Marie?" asked Ishmael.
"I did," said Art. "Boy."
"Three kids," said Ishmael. "What's she going to do?"
"I don't know," said the sheriff. "She say anything?" "Not a word."
"Well, what's she going to say?"
put in William Joe Vogg.
"What can she say? Jesus Christ."
Ishmael understood by this that Joe Vogg disapproved of journalism. He was a sunburned, big-bellied, tattooed gill-netter with the watery eyes of a gin-drinker. His wife had left him 5 years before. William lived on his boat.
"Excuse me, Joe Vogg," said Ishmael.
"I don't need to excuse nothing,"
Joe Vogg answered.
"Fuck you anyhow, Chambers."
Everybody laughed. It was all good-natured, sort of. Ishmael Chambers understood that.
"Do you know what happened?" he asked the sheriff. "That's just what I'm trying to straighten out," said Art Moran. "That's just what we're talking about."
"Art wants to know where we all was fishing," Marty Johansson explained.
"He don't need to know where everyone was at," Sheriff Moran cut in. "I'm just trying to figure out where Carl went last night, where he fished. Who maybe saw him or talked to him last, that kind of thing, Marty."
"I saw him," said Dale Middleton. "We ran out of the bay together."
"You mean you followed him out," said Marty Johansson. "I bet you followed him out, didn't you?"
Younger fishermen like Dale Middleton were apt to spend considerable time each day at the San Pedro Cafe or the Amity Harbor Restaurant rooting for information. They wanted to know where the fish were running, how other men had done the night before, and where exactly they had done it. The seasoned and successful, like Carl Heine, ignored them, as a matter of course. As a result, he could count on being tailed to the fishing grounds. If a man wouldn't speak, he was followed. On a foggy night, his pursuers had to run in close and were more apt to lose their quarry altogether, in which case they turned to their radios, checking in with various compatriots whom they invariably found to be checking in with them. Hapless voices tuned to one another in the hope of some shred of knowledge. The most respected men, in accordance with the ethos that had evolved on San Pedro, pursued no one and cultivated radio silence. Occasionally others would approach them in their boats, see who it was, and turn immediately away, knowing there would be neither idle conversation nor hard information about the fish they pursued. Some men shared, others didn't. Carl Heine was in the latter category.
"All right, I followed him," said Dale Middleton. "The guy'd been bringing in a lot of fish."
"What time was that?" asked the sheriff.
6:30, around there."
"You see him after that?"
"Yeah, out at Ship Channel Bank with a lot of other guys, after Silvers."
"It was foggy last night," said Ishmael Chambers. "You must have been fishing in close."
"No," said Dale. "I just saw him setting. Before the fog, maybe 7:30, 8 o'clock. "I saw him, too," said Leonard George. "He was all set, out on the bank. He was in."
"What time was that?" said the sheriff.
"Early," said Leonard. 8 o'clock."
"Nobody saw him later than that? Nobody saw him after 8?
"I was out of there by 10 myself," Leonard George explained. "There was nothing doing, no fish. I ran up to Elliot Head real slow-like. A fog run. I had my horn going."
"Me too," said Dale Middleton. "Most everybody took off for long. We came over and got into Marty's fish." He grinned. "Had a pretty fair night there, too."
"Did Carl go up to Elliot?" asked the sheriff.
"Didn't see him," Leonard said. "But that don't mean nothing. Like I said, fog soup."
"I doubt he moved," put in Marty Johansson. "I'm just guessing on that, but Carl never moved much."
"He made up his mind and stuck where he was. Probably pulled some fish off Ship Channel, too.
Never did see him at the Head, no."
"Me neither," said Dale Middleton.
"But you saw him at Ship Channel," said the sheriff. "Who else was there, you remember?"
"Who else?" said Dale. "There was 2 dozen boats, easy.
Even more, but Jesus, who knows?" "Soup," said Leonard George. "Real thick fog. You couldn't see nothing out there."
"Which boats?" asked Art Moran.
"Well, okay," said Leonard. "Let's see now. I saw the Kazaloff, the Islander, the Mogul, the Eclipse. This was all out at Ship Channel I'm talking about."
"The Antarctic," said Dale Middleton. "She was out there."
"The Antarctic, yeah," said Leonard.
"What about over the radio?" said Art Moran. "You hear anybody else? Anybody you didn't see?"
"Vance Cope," said Leonard. "You know Vance, the Providence? I talked with him a little."
"You talked with him a lot," said Marty Johansson. "I heard you guys all the way over to the Head.
Jesus Christ, Leonard."
"Anybody else?" said the sheriff.
"The Wolf Chief," answered Dale. "I heard Jim Ferry and Hardwell. The Bergen was out at Ship Channel."
"That it?"
"I guess," said Leonard.
"Yeah." "The Mogul," said Art. "Whose boat is that?"
"Moulton," replied Marty Johansson. "He got it from the Laneys last spring."
"What about the Islander? Who's that?"
"The Islander is Miyamoto," said Dale Middleton. "Ain't that right, the middle one?"
"The oldest," Ishmael Chambers explained. "Kabuo, he's the oldest. The middle is Kenji. He's working at the cannery."
"Suckers all look alike," said Dale. "Never could tell them guys apart."
"Japs," William Joe Vog threw in.
He tossed the stub of his cigar into the water beside the Susan Marie.
"All right, look," said Art Moran. "You see those guys like Hardwell or Cope or Moulton or anybody, you tell them they ought to come talk to me. I want to know if anybody spoke with Carl last night. From all those guys. You got this? From every last one of them."
"Sheriff's sounding like a hard ass," said Joe Vog. "Ain't this just an accident?"
"Of course it is," said Art Moran. "But still a man's dead, William. I've got a report to write up."
"A good man," said Jan Sorensen, who spoke with a hint of Danish in his voice. "A good fisherman."
He shook his head. The sheriff brought his leg down from the piling, and with care repaired the tuck of his shirt.
"Abel," he said, "why don't you square away the launch and meet me back up at the office? I'm going to walk up with Chambers here. Me and him have got things to discuss."
But it was not until they'd left the docks altogether and turned onto Harbor Street that Art Moran quit speaking idly and came to the point with Ishmael.
"Look," he said, "I know what you're thinking. You're going to do an article that says Sheriff Moran suspects foul play and is investigating. Am I right?"
"I don't know what to say," said Ishmael Chambers.
"I don't know anything about it yet. I was hoping you'd fill me in."
"Well, sure, I'll fill you in," said Art Moran. But you've got to promise me something first. You won't say anything about an investigation, all right? If you want to quote me on the subject, here's my quote. Carl Heine drowned by accident, or something like that. You make it up. But don't say anything about no investigation, because there isn't one.
You want me to lie? Asked Ishmael Chambers. I'm supposed to make up a phony quote?
Off the record? Said the sheriff. Okay, there's an investigation. Some tricky, funny little facts floating around could mean anything where we stand now. Could be murder, could be manslaughter, could be an accident, could be anything. Point is, we just don't know yet. But you go telling everyone that on the front page of the review, we are never going to find out.
What about the guys you just talked to, Art? You know what they're going to do. William Joe Vogg's going to be telling everyone he can you're snooping around looking for a killer.
That's different, insisted Art Moran. That's a rumor, isn't it? And around here there's always going to be rumors like that, even if I'm not investigating anything. In this case, we want to leave it to the killer, if there is a killer, remember, to figure what he hears is just gossip. We'll just let rumor work for us, confuse him. And anyway, I've got to be asking questions. I don't have much choice about that, do I? If people want to guess what I'm driving at, it's their business. I can't help it. But I'm not going to have any announcement in the newspaper about any sheriff's investigation.
Sounds like you think whoever it is, he lives right here on the island. Is that what...
Look, said Art Moran, halting. As far as a San Pedro review is concerned, there is no whoever, okay? Let's you and I be clear on that.
I'm clear on it, said Ishmael.
All right. I'll quote you as calling it an accident. You keep me posted on what develops.
A deal, said Art. A deal.
I'll find anything, you're the first to know. How's that? You got what you want now?
Not yet, said Ishmael. I've still got this story to write. So will you give me a few answers about this accident?
Now you're talking, said Art Moran. Fire away. Ask.
Chapter 5. After the morning recess had drawn to a close, Horace Whaley, the Island County coroner, swore softly on the courtroom Bible and edged into the witness box, where he seized the oak armrests between his fingers and blinked behind steel-rimmed spectacles at Alvin Hooks. Horace was by inclination a private man, nearing 50 now, with a sprawling port wine stain on the left side of his forehead that he often fingered unconsciously. In appearance he was tidy and meticulous, stork-like and slender, though not so thin as Art Moran, and wore his starched trousers high on his narrow waist, and his scant hair slicked from right to left with pomade. Horace Whaley's eyes bulged. His thyroid gland was overactive, and swam, too, behind his spectacles. Something attenuated, a nervous caution, suggested itself in all his movements. Horace had served as a medical officer for 20 months in the Pacific Theater, and had suffered in that period from sleep deprivation and from a generalized and perpetual tropical malaise that had rendered him, in his own mind, ineffective. Wounded men in his care had died. They died while, in his sleepless days, Horace was responsible for them. In his head, these men and their bloody wounds mingled into one recurring dream. Horace had been at his desk doing paperwork on the morning of September 16th. The evening before, a woman of 96 had died at the San Pedro rest home, and another of 81 had expired while splitting kindling wood and had been discovered, sprawled across her chopping block, a milk goat nuzzling her face, by a child delivering apples in a wheelbarrow. And so Horace was filling in the blanks on two certificates of death, and doing so in triplicate when the phone beside him rang. He brought the receiver to his ear irritably,
Since the war, he could not do too many things at once, and at the moment, busier than he liked to be, did not wish to speak to anyone.
It was under these circumstances that he heard about the death of Karl Heiner, a man who had endured the sinking of the Canton, and who, like Horace himself, had survived Okinawa, only to die, it now appeared, in a gill-netting boat accident. The body, on a canvas stretcher, its booted feet sticking out, had been borne in by Art Moran and Abel Martinson 20 minutes later, the sheriff wheezing under his end of the load, his deputy tight-lipped and grimacing, and laid on its back on Horace Whaley's examination table. It was wrapped, by way of a shroud, in two white wool blankets of the type issued to Navy men, and of which there was a great surplus 9 years after the war, so that every fishing scow on San Pedro Island seemed to have half a dozen or more. Horace Whaley peeled back one of these blankets, and fingering the birthmark on the left side of his forehead, peered in at Karl Heiner. The jaw had set open, he saw, and the vast mouth was a stiffened maw down which the dead man's tongue had disappeared. There were a large number of broken blood vessels in the whites of the deceased's eyes. Horace pulled the blanket over Karl Heiner again, and turned his attention to Art Moran, who stood immediately at his side.
"God damn," he said. "Where'd you find him?"
"White Sand Bay," Art replied.
Art told the coroner about the drifting boat, the silence, and the lights on board the Susan Marie, and about bringing the dead man up in his net. How Abel went to fetch his pickup truck and the canvas stretcher from the fire station, and how together, while a small crowd of fishermen looked on and asked questions, they'd loaded Karl up and brought him in.
"I'm going over to see his wife," Art added. "I don't want word to reach her some other way, so I'll be back, Horace, real soon, but I've got to see Susan Marie first."
Abel Martinson stood at the end of the examination table, exerting himself, Horace observed, to grow accustomed to this idea of conversing in the presence of a dead man. The toe of Karl Heiner's right boot poked out of the blankets just in front of him.
"Abel," said Art Moran, "maybe you better stay here with Horace. Give him a hand if he needs it."
The deputy nodded. He took the hat he held in his hand and placed it beside an instrument tray.
"Good," he said. "Okay."
"Fine," said the sheriff. "I'll be back soon, half an hour to an hour."
When he was gone, Horace peered in at Karl Heiner's face again, letting Art's young deputy wait in silence, then washed his glasses at the sink.
"Tell you what," he said at last, and shut the water off. "You go on across the hall and sit in my office, all right? There's some magazines in there, and a radio, and a thermos of coffee if you want it. And if it comes about, I've got to shift this body around, and I need your help, I'll call for you. Sound fair enough, deputy?"
"Okay," said Abel Martinson. "You call me."
He picked up his hat and carried it out with him.
"Damn kid," Horace said to himself.
Then he dried his steel-rimmed glasses on a towel and, because he was fastidious, got his surgical gown on. He pulled on his gloves, removed the shroud of blankets from Karl Heiner, and then, methodically, using angled scissors, cut away the rubber bib overalls, dropping pieces of them in a canvas bin. When the overalls were gone, he began on the T-shirt and cut away Karl Heiner's work pants and underwear and pulled off Karl's boots and socks, out of which seawater ran. He put all the clothes in a sink. There was a pack of matches, mostly used, in one pocket, and a small shuttle of cotton twine stuffed in another. A knife sheath had been knotted to a belt loop on his work pants, but no knife was in it. The sheath had been unsnapped and left open. In Karl Heiner's left front pocket was a watch that had stopped at 1:47. Horace dropped it into a manila envelope. The body, despite the 2 hours it had spent in transport from White Sand Bay to the dock east of the ferry terminal, and from there, in the back of Abel Martinson's truck, up First Hill and into the alley behind the courthouse, where the morgue and the coroner's office could be found beyond a set of double doors that gave onto the courthouse basement,
had not thawed perceptibly, Horace noted. It was pink, the color of salmon flesh, and the eyes had turned back in the head. It was also blatantly and exceedingly powerful, stout and thick-muscled, the chest broad, the quadriceps muscles of the thighs pronounced, and Horace Whaley could not help but observe that here was an extraordinary specimen of manhood. 6'3" and 235 pounds, bearded, blonde, and built in the solid manner of a piece of statuary, as though the parts were made of granite. Though, too, there was something ape-like, inelegant, and brutish in the alignment of the arms and shoulders. Horace felt the familiar envy stirring, and despite himself, noted the girth and heft of Karl Heine's sexual organs. The fisherman had not been circumcised, and his testicles were taut and hairless. They had pulled up toward his body in the frigid seawater, and his penis, at least twice as large as Horace's own, even frozen, lay fat and pink against his left leg. The Island County coroner coughed twice, dryly, and circumnavigated his examination table. He began, consciously, for this would be necessary, to think of Karl Heine, a man he knew, as the deceased, and not as Karl Heine. The deceased's right foot had locked itself behind the left, and Horace now exerted himself to free it. It was necessary to pull hard enough to tear ligaments in the deceased's groin, and this Horace Whaley did. A coroner's job is to do certain things most people would never dream of doing. Horace Whaley was ordinarily a family physician, one of three on San Pedro. He worked with fishermen, their children, their wives. His peers were unwilling to examine the dead, and so the job had fallen to him, by default, as it were. Thus he'd had these experiences. He'd seen things most men couldn't look at. The winter before, he'd seen a crabber's body recovered out of Westport Jensen Bay after 2 full months' immersion. The crabber's skin resembled soap more than anything. He seemed encased in it, a kind of ambergris. On Tarawa he had seen the bodies of men who had died face down in shallow water. The warm tides had washed over them for days, and the skin had loosened from their limbs. He remembered one soldier in particular from whose hands the skin had peeled like fine transparent gloves. Even the fingernails had come away. There were no dog tags, but Horace had been able to obtain excellent fingerprints and make an identification anyway. He knew a little about drowning. He had seen a fisherman in 49 who had been eaten about the face by crabs and crayfish. They'd fed steadily on the softest portions, the eyelids, the lips, to a lesser extent the ears, so that in these areas the face was intensely green. This he had seen in the Pacific War, too, along with other men who had died in tidal pools, astonishingly intact beneath the waterline, but entirely eaten to the bone by sand flies wherever flesh lay exposed to air. And he had seen a man, half mummy, half skeleton, floating in the waters of the China Sea, eaten from below, while his backside, sun-dried, gradually turned brown and leathery. After the sinking of the Canton, there were parts of men floating around for miles that even the sharks had forsaken. The Navy had not taken time to collect these parts. There were living men to attend to. Karl Heine was the fourth deceased gill netter Horace had examined in 5 years. Two others had died in a fall storm and washed up on the mud flats of Lanhedrin Island. The third, recalled Horace, was an interesting case, the summer of 50, 4 years earlier. A fisherman named Wilderling, Alec Wilderling. His wife typed for Klaus Hartmann, who sold real estate in Amity Harbor.
Wilderling and his partner had set their net, and underneath the summer moon had shared, in the lee of their bow-picker's cabin, a bottle of Puerto Rican rum. Then Wilderling, it seemed, had decided to empty his bladder into the salt water. With his pants undone, he had fallen in and, to his partner's horror, had thrashed once or twice before disappearing altogether beneath the surface of the moon-addled sea. Wilderling, it appeared, could not swim. His partner, a boy of 19 named Kenny Linden, hurled himself in after him. Wilderling, hung up in his net, struggled as the boy tried to free him. Though bleary with rum, Kenny Linden somehow managed to cut Wilderling loose with a pocket knife and haul him back to the surface. But that was all he could do. Wilderling had ceased to live. The interesting thing, Horace Whaley recalled, was that in the purely technical sense, Alec Wilderling had not drowned. He had inhaled a large volume of seawater, yet his lungs were entirely dry. Horace had at first offered the conjecture in his notes that the deceased's larynx had clamped down, a spastic closure, to prevent liquid from reaching the deeper air passages. But this could not explain the clear distension of the lungs, which had to have been caused by the pressure of the sea, and so he revised his initial hypothesis and entered in his final report that the salt water swallowed by Alec Wilderling had been absorbed into his bloodstream while he yet lived. In this case, the official cause of death, he wrote, was anoxia, a deprivation of oxygen to the brain, as well as an acute disturbance to the composition of the blood. Chief among his current considerations, as he stood brooding over Karl Heine's naked form, was to determine the precise cause of Karl's demise, or rather to determine how the deceased had become the deceased, for to think of the slab of flesh before him as Karl, Horace reminded himself, would make doing what he had to do difficult. Only the week before, the deceased, in rubber boots and a clean T-shirt, perhaps the T-shirt just now cut to pieces with a pair of angled surgical scissors, had carried his eldest, a boy of 6, into Horace's office in Amity Harbor and pointed out a cut on the boy's foot, sliced open against the metal strut of an overturned wheelbarrow. Karl had held the boy against the table while Horace put in the sutures. Unlike other fathers to whom this task had fallen, he gave no instructions to his son. He did not allow the boy to move, and the boy cried only when the first stitch went in and thereafter held his breath. When it was over, Karl lifted the boy from the table and held him in the cradling manner one holds an infant. Horace had said that the foot must be elevated and went for a set of crutches. Then, as was his habit, Karl Heine paid for the work in cash, taking neat bills from his wallet. He was not profusely thankful, and there was that silence about him, that bearded, gruff, and giant silence, that unwillingness to engage the protocols of island life. A man of his size, Horace thought, must take it as a duty to imply no menace or risk that his neighbors will be wary of him. Yet Karl did little to assuage the natural distrust an ordinary man feels for a man of physical stature. He went about his life deliberately instead, taking no time and making no gestures to suggest to others his harmlessness. Horace remembered seeing him one day flicking his lock blade open and then shutting it against the flank of his leg, flicking and shutting it again and again. But as for whether this was a habit or a threat, a nervous tic, or an announcement of his prowess, Horace Whaley couldn't tell. The man seemed to have no friends. There was no one who could insult him in jest or speak lightly with him about unimportant matters, though on the other hand he was on courteous terms with almost everyone. And furthermore, other men admired him because he was powerful and good at his work, because on the sea he was thoroughly competent, and even in his rough way elegantly so. Still,
Their admiration was colored by their distrust of his size and his brooding deliberation.
No, Karl Heiner was not amiable, but neither was he a bad sort. He had once before the war been a boy on the football team, like other schoolboys in most ways. He'd had a large group of friends. He'd worn a letterman's jacket. He'd spoken when there was no reason to speak, for fun. He had been that way, and then the war had come. The war Horace himself had been to. And how to explain? What could he say to others? There was no longer any speaking for the hell of it, no opening one's mouth just to have it open. And if others would read darkness into his silence, well, then darkness was there, wasn't it? There'd been the darkness of the war in Karl Heiner, as there was in Horace himself. But the deceased. He must think of Karl as the deceased. A bag of guts, a sack of parts, and not as the man who had so recently brought his son in. Otherwise, the job could not be done. Horace Whaley placed the heel of his right hand against the solar plexus of the dead man. He placed his left hand over it and began to pump in the manner of someone attempting to resuscitate a drowning victim. And as he did so, a foam, something like shaving cream, though flecked with pink-hued blood from the lungs, mushroomed at the deceased's mouth and nose. Horace stopped and inspected this. He leaned down over the deceased man's face, scrutinizing the foam closely. His gloved hands were still clean. They had touched nothing except the chilled skin of the deceased's chest. And so he took from beside his instrument tray a pad and pencil and noted for himself the color and texture of this extruded foam that was abundant enough to cover the deceased's bearded chin and his mustache almost entirely. It was a result, Horace knew, of air, mucus, and seawater all mingled by respiration, which meant the deceased had been alive at submersion. He had not died first and then been cast beneath the waves. Karl Heiner had gone in, breathing. But anoxia, like Alec Wilderling, or a waterlogged choking asphyxiation? Like most people, Horace felt the need not merely to know but to envision clearly whatever had happened. Furthermore, it was his obligation to envision it clearly so that in the official register of Island County deaths, the truth, however painful, might be permanently inscribed. Karl Heiner's dark struggle, his effort to hold his breath, the volume of water that had filled the vacuum of his gut, his profound unconsciousness and final convulsions, his terminal gasps in the grip of death as the last of the air leaked out of him and his heart halted and his brain ceased to consider anything, they were all recorded, or not recorded, in the slab of flesh that lay on Horace Whaley's examination table. It was his duty to find out the truth. For a moment Horace stood with his hands linked across his belly, and debated silently the merits of opening the deceased man's chest so as to get at the evidence in the heart and lungs. It was in this posture that he noted, how had he missed it before, the wound to the skull over the dead man's left ear.
"I'll be damned," he said aloud.
With a pair of barber's shears, he cut hair out of the way until the outlines of this wound emerged cleanly. The bone had fractured and caved in considerably over an area of about 4 inches. The skin had split open, and from the laceration of the scalp, a tiny strand of pink brain material protruded. Whatever had caused this wound, a narrow, flat object about 2 inches wide, had left its telltale outline behind in the deceased man's head. It was precisely the sort of lethal impression Horace had seen at least 24 times in the Pacific War, the result of close-in combat, hand-to-hand, and made by a powerfully wielded gunbutt. The Japanese field soldier, trained in the art of kendo or stick-fighting, was exceptionally proficient at killing in this manner. And the majority of Japs, Horace recalled, inflicted death over the left ear, swinging in from the right. Horace inserted a razor into one of his scalpels and poked it into the deceased's head. He pressed the razor to the bone and guided it through the hair, describing an arc across the top of the deceased's skull, literally from ear to ear. It was a skillful and steady incision, like drawing a curved line with a pencil across the crown of the head, a fluid and graceful curve. In this manner he was able to peel back the dead man's face as though it were the skin of a grapefruit or an orange, and turn his forehead inside out so that it rested against his nose. Horace peeled down the back of the head, too, then lay his scalpel in the sink, rinsed his gloves, dried them, and brought out a hacksaw from his instrument cupboard. He set about the work of sawing through the dead man's skullcap. After 20 minutes it became necessary to turn the body over, and so, with reluctance, Horace crossed the hall to Abel Martinson, who sat in a chair, doing nothing at all, his legs crossed, his hat in his lap.
"Need a hand," said the coroner.
The deputy rose and put his hat on his head.
"Sure," he said. "Glad to help." "You won't be glad," said Horace. "I've made an incision across the top of his head. His skull is exposed. It isn't pretty."
"Okay," said the deputy. "Thanks for telling me." They went in and, without speaking, turned the body over, Abel Martinson pushing from one side, the coroner reaching across and pulling from the other, and then, with his head hung over the sink, Abel Martinson vomited. He was dabbing his mouth with the corner of his handkerchief when Art Moran came through the door.
"Now what?" asked the sheriff.
Abel, in answer, pointed a finger at Karl Heine's corpse.
"I puked again," he said.
Art Moran looked at Karl's face turned inside out, the skin of it peeled back like a grape, a bloody foam that looked like shaving cream clinging to his chin. Then he turned away from seeing it.
"Me too," said Abel Martinson. "I got no stomach for this neither."
"I'm not blaming you," the sheriff answered. "Jesus H. Christ, Jesus Christ!"
But he stood there watching anyway, while Horace, in his surgical gown, worked methodically with his hacksaw. He watched while Horace removed the dead man's skullcap and placed it beside the dead man's shoulder.
"This is called the dura mater,"
Horace pointed with his scalpel.
"This membrane here, right under his skull, this right here is the dura mater."
He took the dead man's head between his hands, and with some effort, the ligaments of the neck were extremely rigid, twisted it to the left.
"Come over here, Art," he said.
The sheriff seemed aware of the necessity of doing so. Nevertheless, he didn't move. Certainly, thought Horace, he had learned in his work that there were distasteful moments about which he had no choice. In the face of these, it was best to move quickly and without reservations, as Horace himself did as a matter of principle. But the sheriff was a man of inherited anxieties. It was not really in him to go over there and see what was under Karl Heine's face. Horace Whaley knew this, that the sheriff did not want to see what was inside of Karl Heine's head. Horace had seen Art this way before, chewing his juicy fruit and grimacing, rubbing his lips with the ball of his thumb, and squinting while he thought things over.
"It'll just take a minute," Horace urged him. "One quick look, Art, so you can see what we're up against. I wouldn't ask if it wasn't important."
Horace indicated for Art Moran the blood that had clotted in the dura mater and the tear in it where the piece of brain protruded.
He got hit pretty hard with something fairly flat, Art. Puts me in mind of a type of gun-butt wound I saw a few times in the war, one of those kendo strikes the Japs used.
Kendo? Said Art Moran.
Stick fighting, Horace explained. Japs are trained in it from when they're kids. How to kill with sticks.
Ugly, said the sheriff. Jesus.
Look away, said Horace. I'm going to cut through the duramater now. I want you to see something else.
The sheriff turned his back deliberately.
You're pale, he said to Abel Martinson. Why don't you go sit down?
I'm okay, answered Abel.
He stood looking into the sink with his handkerchief in his hand and leaned hard against the counter. Horace showed the sheriff three fragments of the deceased skull that had lodged in the tissue of his brain.
"That what killed him?" Art asked. "That's complicated," answered Horace Whaley. "Could be he took a hit to the head, then went over the side and drowned. Or maybe he hit his head after he drowned, or while he was drowning. I don't know for sure."
"Can you find out?"
"Maybe.
When?"
"I have to look inside his chest, Art, at his heart and lungs. And even that might not tell me much."
"His chest?"
"That's right." "What are the possibilities?" said the sheriff. "Possibilities?" said Horace Whaley. "All kinds of possibilities, Art. Anything could have happened, and all kinds of things do happen. I mean, maybe he had a heart attack that pitched him over the side. Maybe a stroke, maybe alcohol. But all I want to know just now is, did he get knocked in the head first and then go over? Because I know from this foam," he pointed at it with his scalpel, "that Carl went in breathing. He was respiratory when he hit the water. So my guess right now is that he drowned, Art. With the head wound an obvious contributing factor. Banged himself on a fair lead, maybe. Setting his net and got a little careless. Hung up his buckle and went over. I'm inclined to put all that in my report just now, but I don't know for sure yet. Maybe when I see his heart and lungs, everything is going to change."
Art Moran stood rubbing his lip and blinked hard at Horace Whaley.
"That bang to the head," he said. "That bang to the head is sort of funny, you know?"
Horace Whaley nodded.
"Could be," he said. "Couldn't it be somebody hit him?" asked the sheriff. "Isn't that a possibility?" "You want to play Sherlock Holmes?" asked Horace. "You going to play detective?" "Not really, but Sherlock Holmes isn't here, is he? And this wound in Carl's head is." "It's true," said Horace. "You got that part right."
Then, and afterward he would remember this, during the trial of Kabuo Miyamoto, Horace Whaley would recall having spoken these words, though he would not repeat them on the witness stand. He said to Art Moran that if he were inclined to play Sherlock Holmes, he ought to start looking for a Jap with a bloody gun butt. A right-handed Jap, to be precise. Chapter 6 Horace Whaley scratched the birthmark on his forehead and watched the falling snow beyond the courtroom windows. It was coming harder now, much harder. Wind whipped and silent, though the wind could be heard pushing against the beams in the courthouse attic. "My pipes," thought Horace, "they'll freeze." Nels Goodmanson rose a second time, slipped his thumbs behind his suspenders, and noted with his one good eye that Judge Lew Fielding appeared half asleep and was leaning heavily on the palm of his left hand, as he had throughout Horace's testimony. He was listening, Nels knew. His tired demeanor shielded an active mind from view. The judge liked to mull things soporifically. Nels, as best he could, he had arthritis in his hips and knees, made his way to the witness stand.
"Horace," he said, "good morning."
"Morning, Nels," answered the coroner.
"You've said quite a bit,"
Nels Goodmanson pointed out.
"You've told the court in detail about your autopsy of the deceased, your fine background as a medical examiner and so forth, as you've been asked to do. And I've been listening to you, Horace, like everybody else here, and, well, I'm troubled by a couple of matters."
He stopped and pinched his chin between his fingers.
"Go ahead," urged Horace Whaley. "Well, for example, this foam," said Nels. "I'm not sure I understand about that, Horace."
"The foam?"
"You've testified to having applied pressure to the deceased's chest, and that shortly thereafter a peculiar foam appeared at his mouth and nostrils."
"That's right," said Horace. "I would say this is usually the case with drowning victims. It may not appear when they're first recovered from the water, but almost as soon as someone starts removing their clothing or attempting resuscitation, there it is, generally in copious amounts."
"What would cause that?" Nels asked.
"Pressure brings it up. It results from a chemical reaction in the lungs when water mixes with air and mucus."
"Water, air, and mucus," said Nels. "But what causes them to mix, Horace? This chemical reaction you speak of, what is it?"
"It's caused by breathing. It happens in the presence of respiration.
Now, this is where I got confused,"
interrupted Nels.
"Earlier, I mean. When you were testifying, you say this foam is only produced when you've got water, mucus, and air all mixed together by a person's breathing."
"That's right."
"But a drowned person doesn't breathe," said Nels. "So how does this foam..." "You can see why I'm confused."
"Oh, sure," said Horace. "I think I can make this clear. It's formed, this foam, in the early stages. The victim is submerged and begins to struggle. Finally, he begins to swallow water, you see, and as he does, the air in his lungs is forced out under pressure. And this gives rise to the foam I've testified about. The chemical reaction occurs at the time the drowning victim is ceasing to breathe, or breathing his final breaths."
"I see," said Nels. "So this foam, then, tells you Carl Heine, in fact, drowned, doesn't it?"
"Well..."
"It tells you, for example, that he wasn't murdered first, say, on the deck of his boat, and then thrown overboard. Because if he was, there would be no foam, would there? Am I understanding the chemical reaction correctly? It can't happen unless the victim is breathing at the time of submersion. Is that what you said about it, Horace?"
"Yes," said Horace. "It tells you that, but..."
"Excuse me," said Nels. "Just wait a moment now."
He made his way to where Mrs. Eleanor Doakes sat poised over her stenograph. He worked past her, and nodded at the bailiff, Ed Soames, then picked out a document from the evidence table and made his way back to the witness stand.
"All right, Horace," he said now. "I'm returning to you the exhibit you identified earlier in direct examination as your autopsy report, which you've testified accurately reflects your findings and conclusions. If you would kindly take it and read back to yourself paragraph 4 on page 4, please, we'll all wait."
While Horace did so, Nels returned to the defendant's table and sipped from a glass of water. His throat had begun to bother him. His voice had gone hoarse and reedy.
"All right," said Horace. "Done."
"All right," said Nels. Am I correct in saying, Horace, that paragraph 4 on page 4 of your autopsy report identifies drowning as the cause of Karlheine's death?
Yes, it does.
So your conclusion was that he drowned?
Yes.
Was that unequivocal? Was there any doubt?
Yes, of course there's doubt. There's always doubt. You're not...
Just a minute, Horace, said Nels. Do you wish to say that your report is inaccurate? Is that what you're trying to tell us?
The report is accurate, said Horace Wehrle.
Can you read for the court the last sentence of paragraph 4, page 4 of the autopsy report you have in front of you? Said Nels Goodmanson. The paragraph you read silently just a moment ago, please go ahead and read.
All right, answered Horace. It says this, and I quote, "The presence of foam in the airway and around the lips and nose indicates beyond doubt that the victim was alive at the time of submersion," unquote.
Beyond doubt. That he was alive at the time of submersion. Is that what it says, Horace?
Yes, it does.
Beyond doubt, said Nels Goodmanson, and turned toward the jurors. Thank you, Horace. That's important. That's good. But there is something else I'd like to ask about now, something in that autopsy report.
Okay, said Horace, removing his glasses and biting one stem. Go ahead and ask.
Well, page 2, then, said Nels. At the top, the second paragraph, I believe.
He went to the defendant's table and leafed through his own copy.
Paragraph 2, he said. Yes, that's it. If you could read that back for the court, please. Just the first line will do, Horace.
Quote, answered Horace Wehrle, stiffly. A secondary and minor laceration of the right hand is noted, of recent origin, and extends laterally from the fold between the thumb and forefinger to the outside of the wrist.
A cut, said Nels. Is that right? Karlheine cut his hand?
Yes.
Any idea how?
None, really. I could speculate, though.
That won't be necessary, Nell said. But this cut, Horace, you say in your report that it's of recent origin. Any idea how recent?
Very, very recent, I'd say.
Very, said Nels. How much is very?
Very recent, repeated Horace. I would say he cut his hand on the night he died, and in the hour or two just preceding his death. Very recent, okay?
"Hour or two?" said Nels. 2 hours is possible?
Yes.
What about 3? Or 4, Horace? What about 24?
24 is out of the question. The wound was fresh, Nels. 4 hours, maybe, at the outside. No more than 4, absolutely.
All right, said Nels. He cut his hand, then. No more than 4 hours before he drowned.
That's correct, said Horace Wehrle.
Nels Goodmanson began to pull once again at the wattles of skin at his throat.
"Just one more thing, Horace," he said. "I have to ask about something else that confused me during your testimony. This wound to the deceased's head you mentioned."
"Yes," said Horace Wehrle. "The wound, all right."
"Can you tell us again what it looked like?"
"Yes," repeated Horace. "It was a laceration about 2.5 inches long, just slightly above the left ear. The bone under it had fractured over an area of about 4 inches. There was also a small bit of brain material showing through the laceration. It was evident from the impression left behind in the skull that something narrow, something flat, had caused this injury. That's about everything else."
"Something narrow and flat had caused it," Nels repeated. Is that what you saw, Horace? Or is that an inference?
It's my job to infer, insisted Horace Whaley. Look, if a night watchman is struck over the head with a crowbar during the course of a robbery, the wounds you're going to see in his head will look like they were made with a crowbar. If they were made by a ball-peen hammer, you can see that, too. A ball-peen leaves behind a crescent-shaped injury. A crowbar leaves, well, linear wounds with V-shaped ends. You get hit with a pistol butt, that's one thing. Somebody hits you with a bottle, that's another. You fall off a motorcycle at 40 miles an hour and hit your head on gravel, the gravel will leave behind patterned abrasions that don't look like anything else. So, yes, I infer from the deceased's wound that something narrow and flat caused this injury. To infer, it's what coroners do.
The motorcyclist is an interesting example, Nels Goodmanson pointed out. Are you saying it isn't necessary to be struck by anything to produce one of these telltale wounds? That if the victim is propelled against an object, let's say it's gravel, his own forward motion might produce the observed injury?
It might, said Horace Whaley. We don't know.
So, in the present case, said Nels Goodmanson, might the injury in question, the injury to Karl Heine's skull you've spoken of, might it have been the result of either a blow to the head or the propulsion of the victim against some object? Are both possible, Horace?
There's no way to tell them apart, argued Horace. Only that whatever made contact with his head, whether it was moving toward him or he toward it, was flat, narrow, and hard enough to fracture his skull.
Something flat, narrow, and hard enough to fracture his skull. Like the gunwale of a boat, Horace, is that possible?
Possible, yes, if he was moving fast enough toward it, but I don't see how he might have been.
What about a net roller? Or one of these fair leads at the stern of a gill netter? Are they also flat and narrow?
Yes, that is, flat enough. They
might he have hit his head on these? Is that at least a possibility?
Sure, it's a possibility, agreed Horace.
Let me ask you something else, said Nels. Is there any way a coroner can determine if a wound like this one occurred before or after death? I mean, to return to your earlier example, couldn't I poison the night watchman, watch him die, then club his lifeless corpse over the head with a crowbar and leave behind precisely the same sort of injury as if I had killed him by the latter method?
Are you asking about Karl Heine's wound?
I am. I want to know if you know something. Did he sustain the injury and then die? Or is it possible the wound to the head occurred post-mortem? That he sustained it, or should we say his corpse sustained it, after Karl Heine drowned? Perhaps, say, when he was being brought up in his net by Sheriff Moran and Deputy Martinson.
Horace Whaley thought about it. He took off his glasses, he massaged his forehead. Then he fixed the stems of his glasses once again behind his earlobes and folded his arms across his chest.
"I don't know," he said. "I can't answer that, Nels."
"You don't know whether the wound to the head preceded death or not? Is that what you're saying, Horace?"
"That's what I'm saying, yes."
"But the cause of death, unequivocally, was drowning. Is that right? Am I correct?"
"Yes."
"It was not a wound to the head, then, that killed Karl Heine?"
"No, but..."
"No more questions," said Nels Goodmanson. "Thank you, Horace. That's all."
Art Moran, from his place in the gallery, felt a peculiar satisfaction watching Horace Whaley suffer. He remembered the insult, Sherlock Holmes.
He remembered leaving Horace's office, hesitating before going up to Mill Run Road to take the news to the dead man's wife. He'd leaned against the fender of Abel Martinson's truck, inspecting the hand he'd scraped that morning against a stanchion on Carl Heine's gill-netting boat. Then he'd dug in his pocket for a stick of juicy fruit, first his shirt pockets, next, vaguely irritated, his pants. Two remained. He'd gone through eight already. He popped one in his mouth, saved the other, then slid behind the wheel of Abel's pickup. His own car was parked in town near the docks. He'd left it there earlier that same morning when he'd gone to the harbor for the launch. It made him feel like a fool driving Abel's truck because the boy, frankly, had put too much time into it. It was a high-stacked Dodge, painted burgundy in Anacortes, elaborately pinstriped and with decorative exhaust extensions, pillared just behind the gleaming cab. A schoolboy's play truck, in short. Just the sort of pickup you saw in mainland towns like Everett or Bellingham, the kind kids drove around after football games or on Saturday nights late. Art had to figure that in his high school days Abel Martinson had been moderately restless, that in the interim between then and now he had changed, and that his truck was the last vestige of his former self. Thus he was loath to part with it. But he would, Art predicted, and soon. That was how things went. Driving up to see Susan Marie Heine, Art muddled out his words in silence, revising as he went and planning his demeanor, which ought, he decided, to have a vaguely military architecture with certain nautical decorative touches. To report a man's death at sea to his widow was a task done gravely but with tragic stoicism for centuries on end, he figured. "Excuse me, Mrs. Heine. I am sorry to report that your husband, Carl Gunther Heine, was killed last night in an accident at sea. May I express the condolences of the entire community and—" But this would not do. She was not unknown to him. He couldn't treat her like a stranger. After all, he saw her at church every Sunday after services, pouring tea and coffee in the reception room. She always dressed impeccably for her duties as hostess, in a pillbox hat, tweed suit, and beige gloves. Taking coffee from her sure hand, he'd found pleasurable. She wore her blonde hair pinned up under her hat and a double strand of costume pearls around her neck, a neck that reminded him of alabaster. In short, she was, at 28, attractive in a way that disturbed him. Pouring coffee, she called him Sheriff Moran, and afterward pointed out the cake and mints down the table with a gloved index finger, as if he had not noted them himself. Then she would smile at him prettily and set the coffee service down on its tray, while he helped himself to the sugar. The prospect of telling her about Carl's death was more than just unsettling to Art, and as he drove he struggled to find the proper words, the formula of phrases that would free him without too much fumbling from the message he carried to this woman. But it seemed to him there were none. Just before the Heine place on Mill Run Road, there was a turnout where in August the sheriff had picked blackberries. Here he pulled in, impulsively, because he wasn't ready to do what was required, and with the engine of Abel's Dodge idling in neutral, he popped the last stick of juicy fruit between his teeth, and looked down the road toward the Heine's. It was precisely the sort of home Carl would build, he thought, blunt, tidy, gruffly respectable, and offering no affront to the world, though at the same time inviting nobody. It sat back 50 yards from the road on 3 acres of alfalfa, strawberries, raspberries, and orderly vegetable gardens. Carl had cleared the land himself with a characteristic rapidity and thoroughness. He'd sold the timber to the Torsen brothers, burned his slash piles, and poured his footing all in the space of a single winter. By April the berries were in, and a post-and-beam shed barn, and by summer Carl could be seen framing up walls and mortaring clinker brick. He had meant, or so word at church had it, to build an elaborate bungalow of the sort his father had built years before in the family farm at Island Center.
He'd wanted inglenooks, somebody had said, and an overscaled fireplace and alcoves, built-in window seats and wainscoting, a battered porch base and low stone walls along his entrance walk. But in time, as he worked, he'd found himself too straightforward for all of that. He was a builder, an exacting one, but not an artist, as his wife had put it. The wainscoting, for example, was left out entirely. And he had not built the sort of river rock chimney that stood up so prominently at his father's old place, now owned by Bjorn Andreasen, preferring clinker brick. What he ended up with was a blunt, sturdy house, sheathed carefully with cedar shingles, testimony to its builder's exacting nature. Art Moran, his foot on the brake, chewing his gum and fretting in silence, took in the gardens first, then the front porch with its tapered posts, and finally the overscaled trusses in the gable roof. He took in the pair of shed-roofed dormers that had, despite the original intent of asymmetry, been built formally and in tandem. And he shook his head and recollected having been inside this house, with its exposed roof rafters in the upstairs rooms and Susan Marie's oversized furniture downstairs. He'd attended last October an autumn church social there. But he knew he would not go inside this time. He knew that, suddenly. He'd stand on the porch to deliver his news with his cap resting against one thigh, and then leave without ever entering. He understood that this was not right, but on the other hand, what else could he do? It was too difficult. It wasn't in him. He would call Eleanor Doakes at his office when he was done, and she would alert Susan Marie's older sister, and the sister would come here before long. But he, himself? There wasn't any way he could think of. It wasn't in him to sit with her through this. He would ask this widow to understand that there were matters he must attend to, urgent matters of a professional nature. He would deliver his message, offer condolences, and then, in the spirit of one who knows his place, simply leave Susan Marie Heine alone. He coasted down and turned into Susan Marie's drive with Abel's truck still in neutral. From here, looking east across the rows of trained raspberry canes, the sea was visible beyond the tops of the cedars falling away along the hill. It was a fine September day of the sort they saw rarely, cloudless and June warm if you stood where there was no shade, the sunlight glinting among the white caps in the far distance, so that Art Moran understood what he hadn't before, that Carl had built here not just for the sun it afforded, but for the long view to the north and west. While Carl had cultivated his raspberries and strawberries, he'd kept one eye always on the salt water. Art pulled in behind the Heine's Bel Air and shut the ignition down. And as he did so, Carl's sons came around the corner of the house running, a boy of 3 or 4, Art guessed, followed by another of about 6, who limped. They stood beside a rhododendron bush, staring, in shorts, shirtless, and barefoot. Art took a wrapper out of his shirt pocket and spit his juicy fruit into it. He did not want to say what he had to say with juicy fruit in his mouth. "Hey there, men," he called cheerfully through the window frame. "Your mother home at all?" The two boys didn't answer. They stared at him instead. A German shepherd came stalking around the corner of the house, and the older boy caught him by the collar and held him. "Stay," he said, but nothing else. Art Moran shoved his door part way open, then took his hat from off the seat and put it on the back of his head. "Policeman," said the younger boy, and stepped in beside his brother. "It's not a policeman," answered the older boy. "It's the sheriff or somebody like that." "That's right," said Art. "I'm Sheriff Moran, boys. Is your mother home at all?" The older boy gave his brother a shove. "Go get Mom," he said. They looked like their father. They were going to be big like their father, he could see that. Sun-browned, thick-limbed German children. "You go ahead and play," he said to them. "I'll just go knock. You play." He smiled down at the younger one.
but they didn't go. They watched from beside the rhododendron bush while he climbed to the porch with his hat in his hand and rapped his knuckles against the front door, which was thrown open to reveal Carl's living room. Art looked in, waiting. The walls had been paneled with varnished pine board in which the knots shone luminously. Susan Marie's curtains were of a clean, smooth yellow, tied off crisply behind careful bows, ruffled, valanced, and under-tiered. The concentric circles of a braided wool rug concealed most of the floorboards. In one far corner, an upright piano loomed. In another sat a roll-top desk. There were twin oak rockers with embroidered cushions, twin walnut end tables astride a worn bench sofa, and a plush easy chair beside a gilt brass floor lamp. The chair had been pulled up to the oversized fireplace Carl had built, inside of which stood tall fluted andirons. The sheriff was impressed by the order of this room, its bronze, quiet and syrupy light, and by the photographs on the wall of the various Heinas and assorted Varigs who had preceded Carl and Susan Marie in the world. Stout, impressive, blunt-faced Germans who never smiled for photographers. It was a fine living room, clean and quiet. He gave Susan Marie credit for that, just as he had given Carl credit for the chimney and dormers. And while he stood there admiring her hand and everything, she appeared at the top of the stairs. "Sheriff Moran?" she called. "Hello?" He knew then that she hadn't heard. He knew it was up to him to say it. But he couldn't just yet, couldn't bring himself. And so he only stood there with his hat in his hand, rubbing his lips with the ball of his thumb, and squinting while she came down the stairs. "Hello," he said, "Mrs. Heine." "I was just putting the baby down," she answered. It was a far different woman from the one at church, the winsome fisher wife serving tea and coffee. Now she wore a dull skirt, no shoes, and no makeup. She had a diaper draped over her left shoulder, spittle-stained, and her hair had not recently been washed. In her hand was a baby bottle. "What can I do for you, Sheriff?" she asked. "Carl hasn't come home yet." "That's why I'm here," Art replied. "I'm afraid I have some bad news to report. The worst sort of news, Mrs. Heine." She seemed at first not to understand. She looked at him as if he'd spoken in Chinese. Then she pulled the diaper from her shoulder and smiled at him, and it was his duty to make clear this mystery. "Carl is dead," said Art Moran. "He died last night in a fishing accident. We found him this morning tangled in his net out in White Sand Bay." "Carl?" said Susan Marie Heine. "That can't be." "It is, though. I know it can't be. I don't want it to be. Believe me, I wish it wasn't true, but it is true. I've come to tell you." It was strange the way she reacted. There was no way to have predicted it ahead of time. Suddenly she backed away from him, blinking, sat down hard on the bottom stair, and set the baby bottle on the floor beside her toes. She dug her elbows into her lap and began to rock with the diaper between her hands, wringing it between her fingers. "I knew this would happen one day," she whispered. Then she stopped rocking and stared into the living room. "I'm sorry," Art said. I'm going to call your sister, I think, and ask her to come on over. Is that all right with you, Mrs. Heine?" But there was no answer, and Art could only repeat that he was sorry and step past her in the direction of the telephone. Chapter 7. In the back of Judge Lou Fielding's courtroom sat 24 islanders of Japanese ancestry, dressed in the clothes they reserved for formal occasions. No law compelled them to take only these rear seats. They had done so instead because San Pedro required it of them without calling it a law. Their parents and grandparents had come to San Pedro as far back as 1883. In that year, two of them, Japan Joe and Charles Joes, lived in a lean-to near Cattle Point. 39 Japanese worked at the Port Jefferson Mill, but the census taker neglected to list them by name, referring instead to Jap Number 1, Jap Number 2, Jap Number 3, Japan Charlie, Old Jap Sam, Laughing Jap, Dwarf Jap, Chippy, Boots, and Stumpy. Names of this sort instead of real names. By century's turn, over 300 Japanese had arrived on San Pedro, most of them schooner hands who jumped ship in Port Jefferson Harbor in order to remain in the United States. Many swam ashore with no American currency and wandered island trails eating salmon berries and matsutake mushrooms until they found their way to Japtown. Three bathhouses, two barbershops, two churches, one Buddhist, the other a Baptist mission, a hotel, a grocery store, a baseball diamond, an ice cream parlor, a tofu shop, and 50 unpainted and slatternly dwellings all fronting onto muddy roads. Within a week, the ship-jumpers possessed mill jobs, stacking lumber, sweeping sawdust, hauling slab wood, oiling machines, worth 11 cents an hour. Company books, preserved in the Island County Historical Archives, record that in 1907, 18 Japanese were injured or maimed at the Port Jefferson Mill. Jap number 107, the books indicate, lost his hand to a ripping blade on March 12th and received an injury payment of $7.80. Jap number 57 dislocated his right hip on May 29th when a stack of lumber toppled over. In 1921, the mill was dismantled. All of the island's trees had been fed to the saws, so that San Pedro resembled a bald stump desert. The mill owners sold their holdings and left the island behind. The Japanese cleared strawberry fields, for strawberries grew well in San Pedro's climate and required little starting capital. All you needed, the saying went, was one horse, one plow, and a lot of children. Soon some Japanese leased small plots of land and entered into business for themselves. Most, though, were contract farmers or sharecroppers who worked in fields owned by Hakujin. The law said they could not own land unless they became citizens. It also said that they could not become citizens so long as they were Japanese. They saved their money in canning jars, then rode home to their parents in Japan, requesting wives be sent. Some lied and said they'd gotten rich, or sent pictures of themselves as younger men. At any rate, wives came across the ocean. They lived in cedar slat huts lit by oil lamps and slept on straw-filled ticks. The wind blew in through the cracks in the walls. At 5 o'clock in the morning, bride and groom both could be found in the strawberry fields. In the fall, squatting between the rows, they pulled weeds or poured fertilizer out of buckets. They spread slug and weevil bait in April. They cut back the runners on the yearlings first and then on the 2- and 3-year-old plants. They weeded and watched for fungus and spit bugs and for the mold that grew when it rained. In June, when the berries ripened, they took their caddies into the fields and began the task of picking. Canadian Indians came down each year to join them at working for the Hakujin. The Indians slept at the verges of fields or in old chicken houses or barns. Some worked in the strawberry cannery. They stayed for 2 months through raspberry season, then they were gone again.